Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hi, I'm Chanti.
And I'm Lynx, and you're listening to Muses.
Enjoy the show. Hey everyone, Chanti here, and I'm really looking forward to presenting our final episode of 2018. It has been an incredible year with some incredible guests, and I keep thinking to myself, wow, just when I think it can't get any better, it always does. So I want to thank so much our listeners. We love you guys. Today, we have an incredible guest. His name is John Scott. And, you know, I don't know, but I think that there were some angels at work here, because when I got the email asking if I wanted to interview John Scott, the author of Tom Petty and Me, My Rock and Roll Adventures with Tom Petty, I was floored. I thought, does this person know how much of a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers fan I am? And actually, turns out she didn't. And John's name could have been sent to any of the amazing music fans on our network to have interviewed him. And I just feel so honored and like it was really meant to be that he came to us. And what an incredible time we had interviewing him. We got to ask him questions about what it was like being a promo man, what it was really like behind the scenes, running around, doing everything. And then, of course, we got to ask him about those really special and intimate times getting to know the one and only Tom Petty. It's been really difficult since Tom has passed for me, and I know for a lot of people. And this was a really special way to sort of bring some things together. I know for me, I've had a hard time speaking about Tom since his passing, and I had released an episode of just my thoughts and my feelings, and since then I haven't said a whole lot, so it was really special to be able to share some things that I've learned and that I feel with John, and in him I know that we have definitely found a kindred. So in this episode, John is going to tell us about some incredible experiences and times he spent with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, being on the road, being a friend, being a part of his family. And then he also tells us some incredible stories that you won't find in the book. So I really hope that you enjoy this last episode of 2018. I really hope that you go to TomPettyandMe.com and check out John, buy his book. I have given a copy to my brother. I have given a copy to my dad. It is just worth sharing. It's worth reading. It's worth enjoying, whether you are a Tom Petty and Heartbreakers fan or not. But I mean, how can you not be? It is just a fantastic read. And when I posted on Instagram that I couldn't wait to do this interview, people had replied, some people who knew John replied, he is the real deal. He is a fantastic man. Just the positive words that were being said about this guy were outrageous. And you'll be able to tell that from the interview, just what a beautiful heart this man has. So have a wonderful holiday season, everybody. Enjoy this episode, and we'll see you in 2019. Hey, Lynx, have you ever dreamt of marrying a rock star?
Of course.
Well, for all of you out there who finally got your rocker to put a ring on it, let us tell you about Zola.
Zola is the wedding company that will do anything for love, and it's reinventing wedding planning and registry experience to make it the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. From engagement to wedding and decorating your first home, Zola is there combining passionate customer service with modern tools and technology, all in the service of love.
And didn't some wise men once say that all you need is love?
So true.
Sola is the easiest way to plan your wedding and registry. Join the 500,000 couples who have taken the stress out of planning by using Sola with free wedding websites, your dream wedding registry, affordable save the dates, as well as invitations and easy-to-use planning tools.
Start with a free wedding website. It's so easy and takes just minutes to set up. Sola makes it easy to personalize your favorite design with all of your wedding details and has over 100 beautiful website designs to choose from that fit any couple's style and type of wedding.
Then build your dream registry, which you can put right onto your wedding website so your guests can get all the details they need as well as buy your wedding gift, all in one convenient and beautiful place. The Sola store has the widest selection of gifts with over 500 top brands to choose from, all at different price points. There's something for every guest to give, and they will love the free shipping and returns, price matching, and more. They also have the best completion discount, 20% off remaining gifts on your registry starting right after your big day.
To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Sola, go to zola.com/muses.
That's zola.com/muses, or for you Americans, zola.com/muses.
That's right. To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Sola, go to zola.com/muses.
So, John, this is such an honor. It's such a pleasure. This is what we live for, is talking to people like you. And this was,
I can tell.
This is really, really special for me. When the email came through that this book, that the author of this book, we would be able to have a chance to chat with, my first thought was, wait, does she know how big of a Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers fan I am?
Really?
The first thing that anyone learns about Shanti is her deep, deep passion for Tom Petty. Tom Petty is just the love of her life, her music idol. So, yeah, this was definitely a special one to get.
So you want me to tell you what's happening with me right now?
Yeah.
I got goosebumps and the hair standing up on my body when you said that. Seriously, that's what happens to me when I hear something great or somebody like you says something which you just said. I get goosebumps.
Yeah, and that's when that email came through, that's how I felt. So before Lynx came on as co-host, I only did the podcast for about 10 episodes before she came on as co-host. And my picture, right, the main podcast picture, was I had recreated the Damn the Torpedoes album cover.
Fantastic.
And so the email came through and I just went, wait, does she know? And she actually didn't. And you could have gone to anybody on our network. And those guys on our network are amazing. And they can talk rock and roll, like rock and roll under the table. But it came to us. And then as soon as I started reading and you started talking about serendipitous moments and coincidence,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then I knew we were on.
Yeah.
You know, that happens to me all the time in my life. Sometimes I use the word serendipitous a lot, but I really think things happen for a reason.
Yeah, Shanti and I definitely experienced that as well, and with the podcast too. Everything seems to, you know, come together for a reason, and we're really excited to be talking with you tonight. So thank you.
So let's have some questions.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Not only are you can be hailed as the promo man who saved Tom Petty's career, you had a genuine friendship that lasted a lifetime. So first of all, we'll just say thank you for writing this incredible book, Tom Petty and Me, My Rock and Roll Adventures with Tom Petty. Yeah.
So much fun to read.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to make it fun, and I didn't want it to be 300 pages because sometimes I read books and they have like chapter one. Well, I was born in a small town in a small house in Memphis, Tennessee, and my sister scratched my record. But it goes on for like two chapters, and I just get, I'm just going to cut to the chase and start when I was 31 years old.
Yeah, and it feels very personal. And when we're reading it, you're kind of along for the ride. So it was definitely so much fun to kind of, like Shanti and I said to each other, we kind of like read it in Petty's voice, and you can hear
when he says things to you. We heard it. It was good.
Thank you so much. That makes me feel so good.
So, yeah, I mean,
goosebumps again.
You didn't include, you know, I grew up here and my sister scratched my record. And, I mean, we wouldn't have minded because we do enjoy those kinds of books as well. But because we have the opportunity to chat with you, then we can ask you a little bit about that. So, of course,
sure,
we're
going to
talk
ahead.
A lot about Tom. We added a bit more, you know, questions about him. But your driving passion for music, when did that start? Was it when your sister scratched your record? Like, what were you saying about that?
Probably when I was about 10 years old, because I was born in Memphis, Tennessee. And you may not know this, but Memphis is the home of the blues.
Oh, yeah.
The birthplace of rock and roll, and it's the cradle of soul. So I was exposed to blues. They're the first African-American station in America started in Memphis. And B.B. King was one of the DJs, and I heard the blues and while my parents were gone. And then I heard Elvis and then Stax Records. And so, but it started around 10 years old. And my mom would call a radio station every Saturday morning because they took requests. And she would say, request a song for Louise and her brothers, and she would name her brothers. And then when the DJ would come on and say her name, she had this big smile on her face. And I would do anything for my mom to make her smile. So I said, I'm going to be a DJ.
Aww.
And so she encouraged my father to buy me a tape recorder. And I just started practicing. Because I knew I was going to be a DJ around 10 years old because I just loved all the music I was hearing, the different music. And I would lay in bed. I don't know if you've ever done this before, probably not, but I would take a book and hollow it out and put a little transistor radio in there. And
wow.
I'd put it under my pillow at night. And I was there. I was listening the night that I say rock and roll was born, when Elvis Presley was played for the first time.
Hmm.
So I was young, but I knew I was going to be a DJ, and I also, believe it or not, knew I was going to be a promotion man.
Wow.
Because when I was about 15 or 16, and maybe you've heard the song, maybe you haven't, it's by the Rolling Stones, it's called West Coast Under Assistant Promo Man. And I knew I was going to be a DJ, and then I said, that job sounds pretty cool, too.
Wow.
So I'm going to be a promotion man. And that happened, too.
That's crazy.
No, I totally agree. It's one of those things that it happened for a reason, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
The people say, oh, you're just making that up. No, I'm not making that up. It's true. And that's how I got a passion for music, because I was hearing some of the greatest music of all time on my radio. And that's what got me I became a DJ. And I worked at a progressive rock station in Memphis called FM 100, and we were able to play whatever we wanted to play and say what we wanted to say.
Hey, hey, hey.
And hey, hey, hey. And so I loved it. I was like, you know, I was just going crazy. I'm a DJ at a rock and roll station. And my father didn't like that, though, because before it went to rock, it was a played MOR music, middle of the road music, kind of like Doris Day and, you know, stuff like that. And how much is that doggy in the window or something? And I just said, and Dad, it's going to be great. Anyway, so we signed on the air in 1967, and I worked there until about 1974, and I worked 7 to midnight. And it was a time of my life. I mean, people would call, and I could request, and they would request a song, and I would play it. But I didn't play bad music. I only wanted to play good music, because the minute I played something bad, my audience knew it.
That's amazing.
But anyway, so that's how I got into, I had a passion for music. And I'm not sure if you want to know how I got into the promotion business.
We do.
Okay. Well, so when we were able to play anything we wanted to, we were probably one of the first stations in America to play David Bowie.
Of course you were.
ZZ Top. ZZ Top. As a matter of fact, I have an interview from 1972 with David Bowie, and he came to Memphis on his second American tour, and he sold out two shows, and he came over to my house that night for a party we were having. And I got a knock on the door, and he was with his wife. I was like, I almost couldn't tell who was who. They looked so much alike.
Yeah,
but anyway,
Angie.
So we played a lot of new artists. So promotion people started hanging around the station, and they'd take us out to dinner. Excuse me. Usually money was no expense. And so I went, you know, they're making more money than I am, and they have an expense account. And I play records, turn my audience on to, and they play music for radio stations to turn them on to. So I said, well, this is kind of the same thing. So MCA Records one night came and hired me to be the local promotion guy in Memphis. And I took the job, and I was sad to leave radio, actually, but I couldn't wait to be a promotion man. And I got the job, and I remember I was taking Olivia Newton-John to Nashville when she first had a song out. And MCA gave us a cassette of all the new releases. They were working, and somewhere in the middle of that tape was a song called Depot Street by Mudcrutch. And I took it to the FM station there in Nashville, and they said, we like that. That sounds good. We like that. We'll play it. So I called MCA right away and went, I got my first radio ad, Mudcrutch, Depot Street. And he said, John, that's only a single. It's really not a priority for us. Forget about it and work Olivia Newton-John's new record. So I did. I forgot about Mudcrutch. I had no idea who they were. I just liked the song Depot Street. So I've got the job, and I'm doing pretty good. They moved me to Atlanta within a couple of months as regional promotion head of MCA. And about 2 months later, I was doing really good, and I was having a great time because I got to know Leonard Skinner, and they were in Atlanta, and we hung around Leonard Skinner a lot, and I got to learn to love those guys. And anyway, I got moved to Los Angeles all of a sudden for head of album promotion. And when I got here, I was like, the MCA building was on the back lot of Universal Studios, so I could walk out the door for lunch and see, you know, Rock Hudson or Doris Day or whatever star, you know, was filming that day. And we had free run of the MCA of Universal City, and I was like a kid in a candy store. I was working with some of my idols, and part of my job is to go with the artist on a tour. And so one of my favorite bands in the world are The Who. And I remember listening to them when I was a kid growing up. And then as a DJ, I was able to play The Who. And then all of a sudden I look over and I'm sitting next to Pete Townsend in a private plane.
It's crazy.
And I'm like, how good can it get? And I ask him a question. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to sit here. I'm just going to ask him a question. And I did. And I said, Pete, who was your guitar hero when you were growing up? And he said, Steve Cropper. And Steve is from Memphis. So he said, do you have any stories about Memphis? I was going, oh my gosh, Stax Records, yeah, I got lots of stories. But anyway, I was having the time of my life, and it couldn't get any better until a kid named Johnny Cougar came out on MCA Records.
Oh yeah, we definitely have some questions about that. Yeah.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% back at hundreds of stores, and it's all happening this week, May 6th to May 13th. It's the perfect time to shop for everything on your list for spring and summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. I know I'm using this week to stock up on some warmer weather essentials at Ray-Ban and Ulta, and I love that Rakuten even helps me save on travel at sites like Hotels.com. Rakuten really is the best way to shop, and you can save even more by stacking cash back on top of deals. Plus, during Big Give Week, that cash back is bigger than ever. With Rakuten, membership is free. And when you sign up and shop today, you get an extra 10% cash back boost. That's an extra 10% cash back on top of the 15% cash back. You won't see higher cash back rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Shoppers get it.
You know, and I totally relate to what you're saying about just like looking around and saying like, can it get any better? Or like, wow, like I'm here now. Because Lynx and I have been having those similar kinds of things, you know, like we're just kind of two humble Canadian girls that just have this passion and this dream. And so we said, let's just do it. And it's wild how it starts to grow and it snowballs. And then all of a sudden you're meeting these people that you've loved for years and you're chatting with people that, you know, all of a sudden you're there, right there with them. You're not just that observer from the outside, like so many people are. Like you said at the beginning, people just wanted to be a part of it. They either wanted to be a musician, or they wanted to work in music, or they wanted to be a DJ. And to actually say, hey, I'm here and I did it, is wild. And we have a little Memphis story for you. So Lynx and I have not been too much. I mean, I've never really been to the United States. And this summer we went on a trip to Tennessee. And we went to Nashville, and we went to Memphis.
Yeah, we went to Graceland, we went to Stax, and we went to Sun. Yeah, and the definite highlight of our trip was getting asked to record an episode of our podcast at Sun Studios.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Crazy when those moments happen, and, you know, you just... you pinch yourself. You just can't believe how life works like that. You know, it's crazy. Serendipitous.
You guys keep giving me the goosebumps when you say things like that.
Well, yeah,
because how incredible.
Yeah, we definitely related to your book and talking about those moments. And
then we read and you're like, oh, he's from Memphis? Because all of a sudden, since we've come back, it's been Memphis this, Memphis that. Like, it's, and then even the, yeah, it's wild. So, speaking of, you know, Johnny Cougar and John Mellencamp here. Thanks, you can take this one.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was interesting. You were talking earlier about hollowing out your books and putting your radio in there. Like, listening to the radio, that was your research. That was you learning and, you know, honing your instincts on what was good, what made a good record, what made a good song. And
absolutely.
You definitely showed that in the Johnny Cougar story, where you spotted talent there. If people don't know who Johnny Cougar is, they certainly know who John Mellencamp is. You really backed him, and you knew an amazing artist when you saw one.
I did.
I find it amazing, like the people around you, you know, didn't really see that or doubted that. And I guess in a way,
you want to know why?
Yeah.
Well, like I said, everything was great until we have these meetings every week at MCA where all the heads of sales and promotion and marketing get together and discuss records. And at one meeting, the last thing the president did is says, here's a record by a kid named Johnny Cougar. Has anybody heard this record? And I was the only one to raise my hand. I said, yeah, I kind of like it. And he played the song that I liked. And after about 30 seconds, he picked it up and said, who would play a record by a kid named Johnny Cougar? That's the stupidest name I've ever heard in my life. And he said, who signed this guy? And the guy held his hand in the back and said, well, I signed him because of a couple of demos I heard, and his manager is Tony DeFreeze. And when I heard Tony DeFreeze, he was David Bowie's manager. Yeah. So I know Tony DeFreeze is a smart guy, and if he likes Johnny Cougar, I'm going to like Johnny Cougar. I don't care. And so they flew me to Seymour, Indiana to see him. I was the first person to see Johnny Cougar. And he did a special concert, I guess, for me. And he knocked me out. I could tell he had it. He's like that Midwestern swagger, like a Bruce Springsteen kind of thing. So I just started going crazy, trying to get him played on the radio. And I did a lot of some stunts. Like I took a cougar. I ran into Cougar. You have to call up MCA Central Casting and whatever you want to do. And we ordered a cougar. And they thought we were crazy, too. So we went all over L.A. with a handler, came with the I think the Cougar was in a Tarzan movie or something. I don't know. And we went to radio stations and we went to Tower Records and just took pictures and had a blast. And those pictures made some of the trade magazines. And so I'm going, you know, this is good. But all of a sudden, Tony DeFreeze found out that I liked the record and I'd gotten a few stations to play it. He called and told the president he wanted a billboard in Sunset Strip with this kid named Johnny Cougar. Mm-hmm. And of course, that rankled the brass at MCA because it was like a $25,000 proposition to get a billboard back then. And so they came to me and said, John, we don't like Johnny Cougar. We don't like his music. We don't like his manager. So stop working the record.
Wow.
And I said, I can't. This guy's going to be a star. And they said, stop working the record. I said, I can't. I got the biggest radio station in America to add this record today. And again, he said, stop working Johnny Cougar. I said, I can't. And he said, you're fired.
That's crazy.
And all of a sudden, I was being escorted out of MCA Records with a security guard. And I was just like stunned. I couldn't believe it, that I was out of a job. And I was doing my job good, I thought. Anyway, so about a month passed, and I got the phone call from a guy named Charlie Miner, who's a legend in the music business. And he asked me, well, first of all, he asked me, why'd you do that Johnny Cougar thing? And I said, because he's going to be a star. And he said, well, whatever. And then he offered me the job as head of album promotion at ABC Records. And I jumped all over it because Charlie Miner, the head of promotion there, was a hero of mine because he was like the king of promotion. He had so many contacts, and he just used them to his advantage. And so I said, absolutely, yes. I wanted to be working with Charlie Miner. And the reason Charlie and I knew each other is because he was a promotion guy from Atlanta and who visited Memphis all the time. And he always told me, John, you got a good ear for music, so you can spot a hit a mile away. So that's how one of the reasons Charlie hired me to be head of album promotion in Los Angeles for ABC Records.
Another serendipitous moment.
Absolutely. You know, I thought it was the worst thing in the world that I got fired.
And I love those stories. Things going really wrong before they go really right.
Yeah. Right. And then, of course, as it turns out, if I didn't get fired by MCA, I would have never met Tom Petty.
That's right.
The first day on the job, Charlie made me hold my hand up and swear I would never do a Johnny Cougar stunt again because that kid's going nowhere. And you have to raise your right hand and say, I will not do a Johnny Cougar stunt again. I did, but when I raised my right hand, my left hand was behind my back. I had my fingers crossed. So,
good thing.
Thankfully.
Well, because if I hear something I like, I'm going to go to the wall for it. And but anyway, so I said, I won't do it. But 3 days later is when that album came falling out of my closet where I hung my coat.
That is wild. And actually, Lynx and I just made a connection at the same time. We both looked at each other when you were talking about Johnny Cougar, how they had judged him by the name, but you had judged him by the music, and then you swore not to do it again. But then, like you just said, that record dropped. You were curious. It had no name, no nothing. And
put it on.
You put it on.
It had zero on the record about the artist. I didn't have any idea who it was.
But, you know, maybe good thing, because everybody else had judged it. I mean, knowing you, you probably wouldn't even still, because you didn't judge Johnny for his name. You wouldn't have judged Tom by the cover, but a lot of people did, right?
Yes, a lot of radio people, especially radio people.
Yeah.
When the album came out, punk music was just kind of starting, but FM stations weren't playing the Ramones yet. Mm-hmm. Or, they were playing Blondie, but she isn't considered, I guess, I'm sure she's new wave or something. I'm not sure what she was considered, but FM radio was just not playing. And so the majority of the stations just looked at the cover and just tossed it.
It's crazy.
And
for people who might not, you know, be as diehard fans as we are, what we're talking about is the album cover, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers' first album, and it's a picture of only Tom. It's a solo shot, and he's wearing a leather jacket. He's
got a smirk,
and like a bullet necklace coming down kind of near the leather jacket. So people really thought they judged it as a punk record before listening to it. And then 8 months after the record was out, you get something dropped into your office with no name, no cover. It's this album.
Total accident.
Yeah.
It fell.
We both had like no idea how much an album cover could impact an artist's success so drastically. Do you think it would have sold better if it was a full band shot, or like how could one misstep cause so many problems?
You know, that's one thing I regret in my life, that I never asked Tom, why did he have that picture on the front of that first album? I never asked him, and I wish I had of. But I never did ask him, because I guess I was so infatuated with the music, I didn't care what the cover looked like. Mm-hmm. Because when I picked it up and listened to it, I heard Breakdown, I heard American Girl, and I got the goosebumps and put the headphones on, listened again, same thing happened, and I ran to my boss, Johnny Miner. I said, who are these guys? He said, he took the record out and put it on the turntable, and he listened for about 10 seconds and said, oh, that's that band, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They're a punk band. And I looked at him like, what do you mean a punk band? He said, well, look at this guy. Like you said, he's got bullets around his neck, black leather jacket on, a smirk.
They weren't a punk band.
And it's been out for 8 months, John. And radio's told us that it's a punk band, which is not really true. Radio didn't even listen to the record for the majority. I mean, there were some stations, of course, that were playing it. But I just couldn't believe you hear American Girl, you don't think of a punk song or Breakdown. And so I just, when I got the job, he said, you got 2 or 3 weeks where nothing's coming out, so you can just make some phone calls to your radio friends and call some of the ABC local guys in different markets. And so when he said we're dropping the band, I said, would you give me 6 weeks to try and change that? And he said, John, no, it's a broken record. It's not going to happen. We're dropping the band. And I got down on my knees and I begged him, because I knew what I heard was something so special that, I was in a trance, I'll be honest with you. I was in a hypnotic trance when I heard that first record. And he said, oh, you're doing the Johnny Cougar thing again. I said, no, Charlie, I'm not. I'm going to do it. He said, well, if you want to do it, go ahead. But you can't buy any advertising. No, you can't spend a dime on this guy. And so I thanked him and ran back to my office and started calling some radio stations. And sure enough, they go, never heard it. Or who are they? And some would say, oh, your ABC local guy came by 8 months ago and gave us that. But no, it's a punk band. And I was just like, so maybe I get into a bigger hole than I thought. And I called a couple of the guys who had stations playing the record, local promotion guys who had in their market, and Boston was one of them. There were two stations playing Tom Petty, and he said the same thing as me. We're getting reaction to it here. Then I called a guy in San Francisco, and he said, John, we're getting reaction to this record in San Francisco. And so it kind of gave me a clue that something was wrong. All of a sudden, Charlie would walk by my office on a daily basis and go, John, look at his watch. Time is ticking by. You got any ads on that Petty guy today? And he would walk away. And I would just laugh because I didn't really have any edge yet. But all of a sudden, by chance, a good friend of mine came to work in Los Angeles to start a new radio station, a new rock station. And he was a good friend of mine, and I ran over to his house the first week he got there. And I had the actual album cover, and I said, "You got to listen to this, Charlie. It's one of the greatest records I've ever heard in my life." And he looked at me like, "Yeah, sure." And he saw the cover. He said, "Are they a punk band?" And I went, "Oh, my God." And so he sat down and freaked out just as much as I did. And he said, "Are they any good live?" I said, "Charlie, I just picked up the record by accident. I have no idea. But by chance, they're playing the Whiskey the following Saturday night, opening for Blondie."
Insane.
And so we went, the two of us. And after the first song, when they came out, I said, "Please be good, and please don't be looking like you're a punk band." And they came out radiating coolness. I mean, Tom had a vest on and a cool shirt and a scarf around his neck, and they played a Chuck Berry song called "Old Carol." And the minute we heard that, we went, "Oh, my God." And then they played "Breakdown." And my friend leaned over and said, "John, I'm going to start playing this record on Monday morning. I'm going to play the hell out of it because it's that good."
Good.
And that was music to my ears. And
it must have been wild for you to have heard that in your office and be like, "Holy shit, like people might not know about this. I might be one of the only people that does know about this." And you know how it could just explode. And then to see them live in that relatively small venue to, you know, opening mm-hmm. for somebody, it was almost like you felt it was your personal mission to now bring this to the masses. And guess what you did? You did it. People listening, he did it.
I went on some people call it a one-man mission, and because Charlie wasn't, nobody was really with me except the two guys in the two cities where they were getting played. And I kind of felt like the Lone Ranger.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how drastically important the role of a promotions man or woman was to the success of an artist.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes people put on a record for 30 seconds and listen to it, and they take it off and go next.
Yeah,
and that's how sometimes artists' careers are, like, you know, made or broken on that 30 seconds. And it was a shame.
It's crazy.
So before you proved yourself to Tom and then had this lifelong friendship, and he knew you had that, you had his back, he kicked you out of that venue, didn't he?
He did kick me out. And it's a funny story, because I was like, I knew this guy, my friend, was going to start playing it Monday morning. And so I was going, "I want to go tell this guy who I am."
Yeah.
And I said, "Hi, I'm John Scott." I said, "I'm the new ABC head of album promotion." And he said, "I don't give a damn who you are. We hate ABC Records." And the whole band was laughing. And he said, "Look over here, guys. Here's the new ABC promotion guy. What do you think about ABC Records?" Now, they screamed, Stan Lynch screamed an obscenity of what ABC stood for. I don't think I should say it, but
it's in the book.
It's in the book.
Yeah, it is in the book, isn't it? I was a little leery putting it in the book, but that's what he said.
And it was a different time.
It was a different time. And then I said, "Tom, have you ever heard your record on the radio in Los Angeles?" He went, "No, why?" And I said, "Well, you're going to hear it Monday morning, and you're going to hear it a lot." And he went, "Bullshit." Actually, he said, he dropped the F-bomb on me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You're just another nut job from ABC Records. And they've done nothing for us in 8 months except advertise us in teen magazines and New Wave magazines." And at that minute, I got it. I got why he was angry. I understood it. But he said, "Get these two nut jobs out of here, me and Charlie." And they were coming over to escort us out. And I just turned around and said, I got to tell you, I don't know why I said it, but I said it because I knew it. I saw it, and I had heard it. And I said, "Tom, I'm going to break your career wide open." Another F-bomb thrown at me. And as we're walking out, I just turned around again and pointed at him. I said, "Tom Petty, my name is John Scott, And every time you hear your record on the radio, you're going to think about me.
Aww.
And went, yeah, right. Just get out of here. And we walked out laughing because we knew what was going to happen.
That's amazing. Down deep,
we knew exactly what was going to happen. I mean, here's this guy opening for Blondie, and there's about 10 people in there. Nobody knew who he was. He was starting to have some traction in Europe, but when he would get home, he was a nobody.
Yeah, because they have better taste over there. We really like
they
British bands
over
too.
There. I love British bands. A lot of Southern people, they just love British bands.
Canadians too, I guess.
Before I went to,
Canadians as well.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. And before I went to the Whiskey that night, I grabbed a New Melody Express or Sounds Magazine from London, and I saw an article about Tom Petty. It wasn't a big article. Article about this great band, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And I went, wow, that's pretty crazy. They know him in England, but nobody knows him here.
It's interesting.
So, yeah. And so Charlie and I went out and laughed, but we did go back to his apartment, and we did listen to the record again to make sure we weren't crazy. And we looked at each other like, John, this is the new Beatles. And I looked at him and I said, I feel the same way.
Wow.
Not the new Beatles, but you know what I'm saying? It's like the future of rock and roll.
Absolutely.
What I'm trying to say.
And you were right. I don't think a lot of people realize like just how drastically important the role of a promotions man or woman was, you know, back then to the success of an artist, and to have someone like you like really pushing for them, like that was so important. You're basically like a 24/7 PR agent for the band. You talk about, you know, calling every radio station you could to like make sure they know who they are, and not just phone calls, but you would travel and wine and dine these people in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get the band interviews, you'd prep them for those interviews, and you were touring with mm-hmm. them as well to like make sure, you know, everything's running smoothly. That's a lot. What was
it was a lot.
What was that like? And like, what was your personal, you know, favorite aspects of the job, you know, discovering the new talent or touring? Like, tell us about that.
Well, both kind of, but like I said, I was traveling with The Who. When they moved me to Los Angeles, I was traveling with Elton John, going to concerts, and The Who, and then Lynyrd Skynyrd. And my job was to get radio stations, well, they didn't have to make me play The Who or Elton John or Lynyrd Skynyrd, but I would travel with them, and I would have a party before the concert and invite all the DJs in town to come, and I passed out tickets, so I would have a bus, make sure they weren't giving the tickets away. And so we got on the bus, and I would go to the concert venue. And every time, from the very beginning, people walked out of that concert and went, my God, a band is mind-blowing. But I loved traveling with the bands that I loved. And yes, in new talent, I love new talent because that's what we were doing in Memphis. We were playing, nobody ever heard of ZZ Top when we started playing them. And so, yeah, I love doing that, trying to hear new records all the time. And I think, making sure everything was right, make sure the artists knew that all the DJs were there. And in Tom's case, we would have a party beforehand. And then we'd have one after the show because I had talked Tom and the band to come by, the whole band, the party. And back then, Tom said, sure. And I had a big suite, and there was, you know, food and drinks and stuff, and some party favors, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, like hats and balloons.
It's green.
Yeah.
It's green. But anyway, so... Oh, I remember so much, and Tom and them were so great, but he was like, why do you have the suite, and we have rooms, we're bunking with each other. Tom would be bunking with Mike or whatever in a room. And I said, okay, I'll let you have the suite tomorrow night, and we have the party. And, of course, he didn't see the people throwing bologna up on the roof or something, but, I mean, the ceiling. And the place is a mess. And he did have the suite one night. We had the party. He came back to me and said, okay, you can have the suite. I don't mind. I don't mind. But no, I'd love that. Traveling with bands is the greatest thing in the world.
Well, you said that they made you feel like a part of the band, like family, and to be in that circle of these, you know, these musical geniuses, these very special, magical people, it kind of is like, well, that means that you're kind of special too, and you're magical too, and you can keep company with these geniuses, these legends.
I mean, I love The Who, and I travel with them, but I never travel with the band like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, because every night I was watching history being made, every concert. And it was one of those things that just, I saw them do 6 encores. The second night I saw them from Santa Cruz, they did 6 encores.
Wow.
And the crowd in a gymnasium, and the crowd didn't want them. They kept applauding for the 7th encore. And finally they stopped. I went backstage. Tom said, "We played every song we knew." And so, it was that kind of experience that, I mean, yeah, The Who were great, Elton John's great, but something was special about this guy and the band. I mean, is there a better guitar player in America than Mike Campbell?
No.
I don't think so.
The answer is no. I love that you're talking about the baloney on the ceiling, the sweets, the, you know, the traveling, because people who love music, love music. People who love Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers love Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. We're talking diehard. And so when they get to hear new stories or a different perspective of something happens, you're really giving people a gift, because we know that people are interested in rock and roll history and this kind of, you know, and you get to give that to people. And that's really special that you have these stories to share. It
Thank
was
you.
Really
and,
that.
You know, I wanted to write stories that nobody has ever heard of, kind of a behind the scenes of what Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers were like, and pictures they'd never seen before.
Exactly.
And it wasn't 400 pages. I wanted it to be a good read and not long, but just tell my stories. And when I started, I'd been writing a book before this, and about my travels with The Who and Leonard Skinner, because
which
I have
are
some
gonna
great
be
stories.
Great. Yeah. We can't wait for those.
Well,
but I know why you did what you did. Yes, go on.
Yeah, and so, but when Tom died, I couldn't write anymore about Johnny Cougar or The Who or John Mellencamp or Leonard Skinner. I was in shock like everybody else. And the Tom Petty fans are like fans I've never seen before in my life.
Agreed.
And Facebook, Tom Petty Nation, it's like they're people are still not over the loss of Tom. Mm-hmm. And I understand that.
They never will be. And it's like Elvis.
Yeah.
No, they never will be. There'll never be another Tom Petty.
That's right.
I would almost say I guarantee that. But some people think this is kind of new agey or something, or not true. But Tom comes into my dreams every now and then. Like a... and I said that to some people, and they went, "Me too."
John,
anyway,
I
Tom
was
came...
going to ask you about that, and I left it out because I didn't want to seem like I thought you all would think I was too woo-woo, but I fucking knew it. I knew it. Please go on.
So, I don't know how long after this he died, but he came to me in a dream, and we were talking, and he said, "Call your book Tom Petty and Me." Because back in May of 2017, I told him I was going to write a book, but it wasn't just about him. But he said, "Well, just tell the truth, John." And so he said, "Call it Tom Petty and Me." And I woke up and I ran to my computer and went to GoDaddy, where I got you get domains, and I typed in TomPettyandMe.com, and it was available. So I clicked, ding, I want it. And when I think I put that on Facebook one time, that he came to me in a dream, and you know, some people don't believe that. But then all of a sudden, the fans started going, "He comes into my dreams too, in and out." And it's just amazing that people experience that, because, you know, some people like, you know, poobah that thing. But anyway, that's what happened.
No, you know, like Lynx and I believed that Elvis gave us a gift when we were in Memphis of recording at Sun. I believe that Tom continues to give gifts, and I believe that this interview is one of them. And I've thought this, and I was like, there's no way I'm going to mention this. I'm going to sound insane, but I think we're all on the same page here. So Yeah, it just kind of brought to mind the song Angel Dream that he has. It's not a song that a lot of people like talk about, but it is one of my favorite ones, and it just makes me believe that like he knows these things too, you know.
I dreamed you.
Exactly.
So far away. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. I can't sing. I'm a terrible singer because I have my own key when I sing. It's called off key. But anyway, that's what happened. And the next day I just got up and started writing and started remembering stories. I never kept a diary, but the stories of Tom always stuck with me. And just like because he was my favorite, Tom Petty and Heartbreakers were my favorite band of all time.
I mean,
yeah, Bruce is great. Stones are great. But there's no Tom Petty in the Heartbreakers.
No. Nope.
Never will be. So I just started writing, and I didn't want to seem like a guy who was just, you know, I'd write a quick book and then cash in the money on Tom's passing away. And I never wanted to do that. So I waited till after the first of the year and kept writing. Mm-hmm. And I actually wanted the book to come out on April 20th, 420. Because I knew Tom would appreciate that particular day.
Yeah, I had a question that I ended up taking out, and it was approximately how many joints do you think you smoked with Tom? But I ended up taking it out.
Well, he wrote a song about it. Let's get to the point. Let's roll another joint. And that's all we did was smoke. I shouldn't say that's all we did. We smoked pot, and we used to listen to new records at his house, or he would play us an old record that he loved. And I never saw him really drink. I never saw him do cocaine. And he may have, but I never saw it. And I was around him a lot. So let's just say hundreds of joints. Because that was the thing to do. And, you know, before I went over to see him, before I went over to see Johnny Cougar, I smoked a joint. But it didn't mean necessarily that if you do that, the music's going to be good.
Yeah.
Because if the music's bad, it doesn't matter, you know, if you're high or not high.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's basically what we did. We would hang around his house and just listen to music. And, you know, I think there's a story in the book about me taking him to a radio station to do an interview. And that's kind of a funny story. But
There are hilarious stories in that book. So that's why I really want people, like, to go and read it. I'm going to, you know, get a copy for everybody that I love. Like, my whole family is Tom Petty obsessed. My brothers, my dad, absolutely obsessed. And there are so many funny little tidbit stories.
It's special because you learn, like, the business side of your relationship. But there's also such a strong friendship there. And your stories of your friendship are so incredible. If you could go back and like relive one special moment or experience or conversation that you had with him, is there a specific memory or moment that you would love to relive?
There is.
Yeah.
After the radio station started playing Tom's song, Breakdown, a lot, his manager called me on Wednesday, and I love his manager, Tony Dimitriadis. But he called and he was angry because he said, "You pissed off my artist. You told him you're going to break his career, and you know you can't. ABC is a terrible record label." And I said, "I'm going to do it." And he hung up the phone and wanted to have a meeting with me. And on Friday, my assistant came in and said, "Tom Petty's on the phone." I'm like, "Oh my God, this is, could go either way here. I don't know what's going to be." And he got on the phone and said, "John, you come over to my house tonight. You're serious, aren't you?" I said, "Tom, I'm going to break your career." And then he said, "Would you come over to my house tonight?" I said, "What's the address?" I wrote it down. And of course, at that point, I'm listening to nothing but the first record in my car, at home, at work. Nothing else mattered. And when I got to his house, it was a whole completely different thing. And we went outside. We smoked a joint outside and just wanted to get to know each other. And I didn't tell him about, I told him about, you know, my life in Memphis, and I was DJing, about the bands I worked with at MCA, but I did not tell him about Johnny Cougar because I knew that he would go, "Oh, yeah, here he is. This guy really is a nut job." But I told him my stories, and then I asked him, "Have you been in any other bands that before Tom Petty and Heartbreakers?" And he said, "Yeah, you never heard of them. They call them Mud Crutch." And I went, "You mean the song Depot Street?" And he went, "How the hell do you know Depot Street?" And I told him the story about one of the first records I listened to was Depot Street. And we started, we kind of just stared at each other for like 30 seconds, like, is this really supposed to be happening? And to me, I was sitting there looking at the lead singer of Mudcrutch, and I was also looking at Tom Petty, who at the time was, I couldn't get him out of my mind. And I said to myself, I can't believe this is happening. And he couldn't either. He really had no idea. But he knew something was going on when I said Mudcrutch on Depot Street. And then he asked me to come inside and play. He said, we're working on this new record. And I knew some new tracks. And you want to hear one? I went, yeah, sure. And he played Listen to Her Heart.
Mm.
And from the opening riff of that song, by Campbell's guitar, you were blown away. And I made him play it like 5 times. But anyway, kind of after that, we became best friends. And I would go with him on interviews and try to teach him how to, really hadn't done any interviews. And I kind of used my DJ experience to tell him, not tell him what to say, but just how to act. And there's one story in the book about one day he was cranky, but I won't tell that story. I'll let you read that story. But
I loved it. I laughed so
much. Kind of a funny story. Yeah, but I think that one moment when I looked at him and he looked at me, and we didn't say anything. That's one moment I can look back on and go, man, that was a trip.
Sure
was. So neither one of us knew what was going to happen next. I kind of knew. I felt I knew. But at that moment, that was the highlight of my life.
Yeah. That's pretty incredible that you got to be with a guy who's so most reclusive, mysterious, private, and you were invited into not just one home, but several homes as they changed over the years. You got to know the family, and it's an honor, you know, that you got to do that. So it must have been a real trip to be inside of his home.
Oh my God.
Those walls that, I mean, what an ultimate pass you had.
Oh, because in the very beginning, I was taking pizzas over to their apartment somewhere in Hollywood, and, you know, they were broke, and I'd bring pizzas over and got to know the band. And, so he started making it, and he bought that house in Encino, California. And every Christmas, Easter, Thanksgiving, Christmas, he would have a party of just his friends. There was no... It wasn't 100 people there, maybe 40 of, you know, some road crew and me and my family. And we all became good friends. And the parties at the Petties were amazing because, like at Christmas, for example, I mean, the weather's nice out here in Southern California at Christmas, usually, and we'd always play softball in his yard. And he was always the pitcher. And he pitched for both teams, I guess because he didn't want to run around. But we played, and the score didn't matter. And then we'd go inside and have dinner and then open Christmas presents. And he and his wife at the time picked out every gift individually for every person there. No gift was the same thing. And that's what blew my mind about those guys, because they had that much, not respect for people, but genuine love for people that were around them. And he gave me a 1940s, he knew I loved radios, old radios, and he gave me this beautiful 1940 retro radio, and it's like, I still got it. And but it always blew my mind that they just picked every gift for the person,
beautiful.
And usually it was like the perfect gift.
Yeah. Well,
so those are times of my life.
Thank you for sharing that. I just said, like, you know, Tom Petty and his music and who he is, he's just the perfect gift.
He's a funny guy, too.
Oh, I know. And it really comes across as that in the book and the stories that you're sharing. And those Christmas messages that you wrote about and that you can go to TomPettyAndMe.com and listen to, like, that was something I never heard before that I needed, that I sent to, you know, like, my dad for a laugh. Yeah, just fantastic.
Oh, yeah. These guys are pretty approachable, too. That's the other thing.
Which is wild, because to many people, they're actually it's like a no access zone, you know, they're the untouchables, right? Almost in a way, it seems.
Oh yeah, exactly. And when Tom got bigger, he stopped hanging around at the parties because he was swamped with people wanting his autograph. And so when he'd go off the stage, he was the first one into a limo. The band would stay for the party, but he was in the limo, and he was probably home in Malibu by the time people were filing out of the Hollywood Bowl, wherever he was playing. But he was just a shy guy. In reality, he was a pretty shy guy. But he would not back down to anybody. And that's another thing I loved about him. I love that, man. He was a gentle giant, but don't cross him. And the band, my God, you fall in love with Stan Lynch. You fall in love with Ben Montaigne. Just, you fall in love with Ron Blair because they're just super, super, super nice guys. And that's another reason I just love this band. There's no attitudes, no, you know...
Yeah, they're all real people. They're good people.
Yeah, they're real people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I listen to Ben Mott on Sirius on Tom Petty Radio, and boy, his shows are so good.
Yeah.
He's such a calm guy, cool.
It's funny, we were going to ask you about, you know, DJ. Like, we have so many questions that we didn't get to that hopefully, you know, we can have another conversation just about the music business in general.
Sure.
Like, you know, because we want to know, if you were a 20-year-old guy in 2018, would you have gotten into music or you know, like that kind of stuff. But
sure.
And you know, just like DJ culture, but it's interesting that it's very much like if you want to play what you want to play, and it's Sirius Satellite Radio that you go to, that there's still like choice there and quality DJs. So would you say that, because we were going to ask, like, who are your kind of go-to DJs now in this day? It's like, what's your radio station in 2018?
Well, I didn't tell you this earlier, but I have an internet radio station.
Amazing.
And it's called AllMemphisMusic.com. And that's what we play. Elvis and Aretha and Otis Redding. And you'll love our station.
Amazing.
When you turn it on. But who am I go-to DJs? Well, I love Jim Ladd. Mm-hmm. Jim Ladd and I had a bunch of great times together on the road. I would take him to, he was always loving to go with me to concerts because I would have stage access. And we watched, like, for example, we watched the Leonard Skinner open for The Who at the Oakland Coliseum, like 80,000 people. And we were on stage. And then The Who would come on, and we were on stage. And that's just the experience that once you have, it's like the most incredible thing to just look out over the 80,000 people from the stage. I think he was sitting on John Entwistle's, not his bass.
His amp?
Bass or whatever it was. Yeah, not his amp, but his... You know, they'd have those big kind
the
of
gear.
Things. I don't know. But
Yeah,
the gear. And I love Jim Ladd. But I'll be quite honest with you. It's hard to turn it off Tom Petty Radio because they still play Tom's voice. And in the beginning, that was kind of tough for me. But I pulled out some old cassettes of interviews that I've done with him. Mm-hmm. And I hear his voice, and it just makes me smile now.
Yeah,
because I know when he says crazy things about, you know, he's on Buried Treasure and he says kind of crazy things and funny things sometimes, it makes me smile because that was him.
Mm.
That was him. And I love the fact that they still play his voice.
Yeah.
And but go-to DJs, you know, that's really about it. I mean, I listen to hockey games more than I do radio these days, but I play fantasy hockey, and so... Anyway, but no, I try to find new bands, and I love finding new bands. Somebody will tell me about a band, or I'll see something in an article, and that's one of my things. I just love to find new music, and it's tougher to find these days. You probably know it's tough to find new bands.
Yeah, yeah, it is. You really do have to search.
And I've got some favorite bands, and I keep thinking, why aren't they stars?
Mm-hmm.
Because the music business is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
These days. And YouTube is probably where you go to find music.
Yeah.
That's wild. Like, I'm an elementary school teacher, and when you ask 6-year-old kids what they want to be when they grow up, half of them say YouTuber. Like, we're in the generation where YouTuber is now an option and a popular option of what children want to be when they grow up.
That's crazy.
It's not rock star anymore, John. It's YouTuber.
Not a promotion, man. Not an artist, a YouTuber.
Yeah.
That's funny. I like that. But, yeah, I still like to find new bands. And there's a little club here in Los Angeles called Hotel Cafe, and a lot of new bands play there. And I like to go there. And sometimes I'll find bands I just love, new bands. And I'll start following them. But this little club is special because only new artists play there. It's a very small place, but a lot of great new bands play there. And anyway, so I go there a lot.
Well, before our time runs out here, there was one moment in your book that I definitely wanted to talk about. It was such a special moment. You were at the Hollywood Bowl for Tom's final concert, and you talk about being there with your daughter and that Petty did something that he very rarely does. He actually dedicated a song to you.
Oof, chill bumps.
What that moment must have been so special.
Well, I went to the memorial for Tom, and towards the end of the evening, his wife Dana, who I love, she was standing there by herself, but people were crowding around her, of course, but she was standing by herself, and she motioned me to come over there. And she said, "Do you know why Tom did that shout out to you?" I said, "Well, I wasn't backstage. I had no idea who was going to do it. Tell me." She said, "Well, we got into our limo about 6 o'clock to go to the Hollywood Bowl. And of course the limo driver knows to have it on Tom Petty radio. And she said that we were talking, and then he said, "Wait a minute, did he just say John Scott's going to be interviewed?" And she said, "Yeah, that's what they just said." He said, "Well, I want to hear this whole interview." And she said, after the interview was over, he turned and looked at me and said, "Every fucking thing he says, the total truth." And I was sitting in the audience. I had no clue he was going to do this. The band didn't even know he was going to do it. I asked Mike Campbell after, "Did you know he was going to do that?" And he said, "No, he never even told us."
Wow.
But I'm sitting there, and I think he played 4 songs. He hadn't really said a word except thank you so much. And he stopped the show and dedicated that song to me. And now I look upon that as a gift that he left me.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Because a week later, he was gone. And it still shakes me to the core. Yeah. And I think you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I almost want to cry right now, to be honest with you. But
yeah. I'm really happy to be sharing this with you, John, because I've only spoken about Tom, and this is just from a fan's perspective, not a friend, once since he passed, and I was by myself, and I recorded something, and I put it up, and I cried when I said it, and I haven't listened to it since, but it's actually the most listened and downloaded episode. And I just remember being like, just thinking about all of the lessons that I've gotten from him and his music. And I haven't really spoken about, Tom or my experiences going to the concerts or just like how I feel about him and what his music has meant to me, like, until now. And to be talking about it with you and with Lynx here beside me is such a wonderful kind of full circle moment in my life for me.
It feels magical.
Well, I feel great right now just talking to you, because I can tell that you guys are sincere about music and love music, but you love Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Well, actually, he gave me a gift as well, because his last show that he played in Toronto, I stood on the side of the stage on Ben Mont's side watching him play the piano. And the way that I was able to do that was because years ago, the first class that I ever taught, my first year of full-time teaching, I had a little girl in my class, and we got along great. And her dad is a roadie. And it just so happened that her dad, years later, messaged me and said, "Hey, I know somebody on the crew." And you might know him, Stanley Green. He did lights.
I don't remember Stanley, to be honest with you.
Well, he might have been newer, yeah, but he did lights.
I think Jim Linehan did lights before him, yeah.
Yeah, so he was the last man to do lights for Tom, and actually, sadly, he's passed since as well. And he invited me up, and I got to see from the perspective of doing the lights, and then he gave me and a friend a pass, and he said, have fun. And we were beside that stage, and we were back there, and there was nobody else there except for us and the crew. And I looked at the stage, and I looked out into the audience, and I just said, thank you. I don't know why I got chosen to do this, and I'm sure you might think that sometimes too, but thank you.
I do feel that same exact way, that I was chosen. This was meant to happen for me to be in his life. And kind of the same way you do. And a lot of times I'll be at dinner with my wife or my daughter and one of his songs will come on. Mm-hmm. And I just look up and smile. And when I was doing the pictures for the book, I went to one photography store, and I would walk in, she'd start working on my files, and a Tom Petty song would come on. And she looked at me, she said, John, this only happens when you come in. Uh-huh. And I said, you know, that happens a lot to me. Yeah. And the owner came over and said, she's not lying, she's telling the truth. I mean, the little things, like I went to my doctor last week, and as I was leaving, she said, oh, John, I'd given her a book, and she said, oh, John, will you bring another book? I got a friend who I want to give as a stocking stuffer. And I said, sure. And, you know, I'll sign it. And if you want me to personalize it, I'll do something like, you know, hey, Bill. She said, how do you know his name is Bill?
That's wild.
I said, I don't know his name is Bill. She said, John, the guy I'm giving this gift is named Bill. Why did you say Bill? I said, I don't know.
Well,
but
it's your magic, and you've had premonitions too. And
it's just full of these serendipitous moments, and this is definitely another one.
And it's so nice to focus on these things, on this magic, on this beauty, on this love, on these things. And we thank you sincerely from the bottom of our hearts, John. And let's continue this conversation when Lynx and I come to LA this summer. In person.
Sure, I got some more stories I'll tell you, sure.
Amazing. Thank you so much. For writing this book.
Thank you so much. This podcast you're doing is something special.
Having
me on there makes me really feel special. And I can tell by you guys talking that you feel the same way I do. And you're like one of those Tom Petty fans in Tom Petty Nation. You're diehard. You're music fans.
Oh,
you
yeah.
love music.
Oh, yeah.
And I can tell that. I can easily tell that. And I love that. So it's an honor for me to be on your show.
Thank you. It's funny. Neither of us work in the music business. We are just two girls with a dream and an idea and a passion. And now, well, I guess we are in the biz. But, you know, who knew that this was going to happen? So
you just got to have that passion.
Yeah. And we just can't wait to come and meet all of these amazing people who we've talked to, you know, over the internet and whose books we've read. And just to kind of keep the stories going and to talk about what music was like, where it is now, and just to learn. Like, I didn't know about what a promo man or woman does. And so it's nice to honor people in the music business who aren't just the artists, because it's a whole team. It's a whole family that makes it go around. So it's nice to hear your story.
Well, I've had people say to me, what would happen if you hadn't picked up that album? Yeah. And I say, I don't know. Oh, well, he could have been signed by another label, probably, maybe. Or he could have broken the band up, or he could have moved back to Gainesville, or... Yeah. There's just nobody knows.
No one knows.
And it's strange that people tell me that and think that, wow.
Yeah, it was definitely meant to be. It was meant to be.
Yes, it was. Thank you so much for saying that. Yes. And you guys are meant to be in my life, I can tell right now.
Yeah. Well, we feel that, and we felt that way when, you know, we went to Memphis too. So it's just wild that here it is coming back again. So thank you, Elvis. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, John Scott, author of Tom Petty and Me, My Rock and Roll Adventures with Tom Petty.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. It means the world to me.
This was seriously what a way to like finish our year.
Yeah. This
what
was
a beautiful way to finish our year. I needed this today.
Yeah.
I needed this week, this month.
Good.
Thank you so much.
You know, I did too. I needed it too, to be honest with you.
Oh, well, you know, we don't call ourselves the muses for nothing. You know, it's a divine shot of inspiration, a little bit of just keep on going.
And it's passion.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Have a great evening, John.
Thanks, John.
You too. Thank you so much.
All right, rock and rollies, that's it for today, and that's it for 2018. I hope that you liked our little conversation with John. I know that I sure enjoyed it, and I was just flying from it afterwards. I cannot wait to get my Canadian butt out to LA and go have another conversation with John in person and to chat with all of the amazing and incredible people that we have talked to so far through the process of this podcast. I really want to sincerely thank everybody listening, everybody contributing, everybody sending and sharing kind messages on Instagram and Twitter and all that beautiful stuff. And I hope that 2009 brings you health and happiness and a lot more rock and roll. If you want more music podcasts, you can head over to rockandrollarchaeology.com. You can find all of the other shows like The Art of Rock with Kosh and The Rock and Roll Librarian and Real Rock on iTunes as well. And you can support our network by donating if you like to our Patreon. And that's it for now, my friends. Take good care. Lots of love from Shanti and Lynx. And that's it. Goodbye.
Hey, I'm Jillian Clare, the host of the podcast Thanks for Coming In. I've accumulated some pretty crazy audition stories over the past 20 years, and so have my friends.
And I was like, you know what? No, not going
to
do this.
And then Disney calls and is like, we need you to come test for the Ant-Man movies.
I didn't know if my scene was going to get cut or not.
Ooh, I could play that.
Tune in every Thursday to hear your favorite actors tell the funniest, saddest, and most cringeworthy audition stories. Sometimes even the one that got away. Thanks for Coming In is available on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.